I want to do something that I don't do very often, which is a bit of a review, which sort of feels very classroomy, you know. But I want to do that because although we touched on a parable last week, it's been a while since we really dug into the stuff that we were on about together in May. And given the way we humans tend to take in new ideas, I'd be surprised if anyone in the room had much retention of the big themes for that exploration. We tend to, like, whenever something like that's coming, kind of in a broadcast environment, one person's talking and everybody's listening kind of a thing, we tend to fix on a particular idea or illustration, and our imagination kind of seizes that and goes to work and just starts, you know, digging our way down into that. And the rest of it sort of goes by the board, which is fine. It's the way we take things in. Or sometimes I think something sort of floats out into the community and some other bit does its work in someone else's imagination and soul. So given the fragmented nature of this, Bonnie and I were talking about this. I don't know, maybe she's out with Miles, but just before a gathering, and she kind of watches out for Miles when she's here. And so she didn't know about the podcasts, so that was a happy discovery for her because it's a chance to fill in the blanks that get created by, you know, dealing with other things, right? And that's, we all have that, whether it's physical in our space or in our mental space. And so I want to just recover some ground because I kind of want to set the framework for what I'd like to spend the next couple of weeks digging into. And then August the 6th, Christina is going to tell us a bit more about her trip. And I'm looking forward to that, too. So now I've made a public commitment, haven't we?
It's official now.
You said yes in the email. I was sure I read it right. Good. I'm looking forward to that. I really am. We spent most of our time, when we kind of were into this before, examining the parables of Jesus, and in particular the parables that reveal his own emerging understanding of what kind of a Messiah he was or was to be and what kind of a Messiah he wasn't. Which is an interesting thought that would have to grow as a comprehension for Jesus. But there's plenty of evidence in the story that suggests that that's what's going on inside of him. I don't know if you regularly have occasion to pick up the kind of camera that allows you more control, so not a point and shoot and not a phone, which is not a camera, I'm sorry. But if you do, or if you've ever tried to take photographs involving single blocks of color as an important part of the composition, then you know that if you point an autofocus device at something that has a sort of a singular dimension, it freaks out and it just doesn't know what to do, right? And that's because the autofocus mechanism in a camera depends for its work on contrast. It needs contrast to bring something into focus, and if I point my camera at a white muslin or a white backdrop with no subject, and then I bring the subject into the frame, it's almost like I can hear my camera kind of sigh with relief. It's like, there, that's what I was looking for. Now I've got something to measure against. And it sort of seems like Jesus has some experiences that are akin to this, some human experiences where he has to encounter the force of what people expect the Messiah to be before he gets clarity about the kind of Messiah that he was to be. I don't know if you were here or if you had a chance to check out the podcast, you might remember how pivotal his experience of feeding this large crowd was to this process. Because after he does this, and he's kind of early on in his public work with people, he's healing folks and he's doing some of these sort of spectacular things. And after this particular story of feeding all these people, the crowd decides they're gonna make him the king. And if he's not into it, they're gonna do it by force, and he has to flee. There's a lot of momentum in the biblical story, and I think in our own ways of thinking generally about humans toward what I called then and what I still like the word plausibility for. For the people of Jesus' time, the plausible picture of a Messiah was someone that would do the kind of things that they initially saw Jesus doing, which is basically fixing stuff. They wanted a Messiah who was going to make right what wasn't right, and they wanted one who was going to do it by mystical, magical force, or just plain old might is right, who was going to gather an army and boot the Romans out and fix it. And we talked a fair bit about the idea of that kind of power as right-handed power, power that we recognize and understand and think of as plausible as humans. And we contrasted that with left-handed power, the kind of power that Robert Farrar Capon calls lastness, leastness, lostness, littleness, and death. It's sort of a downward progression into defeat, not an upward progression into victory from many vantage points. Different kind of power entirely. And so as Jesus starts to get clarity about that being his path, that path toward leastness and lastness, he starts to talk about his own death and resurrection, and that's when people start to get really baffled about what he's talking about. Because this thing he starts talking about, this is not the plausible Messiah that they have been waiting for and hoping for. And in fact, this doesn't make sense to them at all. And so, as the biblical gospels tell the story, Jesus moves on from his parables about the nature of the kingdom of God, where he starts that conversation, and he starts to talk about the idea of grace. And wouldn't you know it, what he does is he takes another long-standing set of expectations and he upends them. Because what religion finds plausible when it comes to pleasing God or connecting with God is that we humans have to earn the right to do that. This is the way religion functions. This is what religion regards as plausible. If something is busted between us and God, the way religion tends to approach fixing that dilemma is to implicitly or explicitly communicate that we need to fix that dilemma. And I don't know if you can resonate with that or not, but if you wonder about whether this idea has any connecting point for you, here's a way to test it. Just pause for a moment. I won't ask anyone to speak about this, just as a disclaimer going in. Pause for a moment and think about your secrets. Think about the things that you've done or that are part of your story that you don't talk with other people about because of shame or guilt or fear. And we don't need to stay there too long right in this moment, because those places can sometimes have a really dark, heavy power about them in our lives that does desperately need to be undone. But if we even touch on those things, then think about the relationship between those kinds of things and religion, or even the relationship between those kind of things in your own life and your ideas about being close to God apart from religion. For most of us, we get into this terrain, there's going to be some aspect to that combination of things, things that are not right and connecting with God, that has to do with something religious or ritualistic that exists in order to sort of pay for our part in those things, in order for God to be willing to be close to us. There's all sorts of different frameworks for that, so I'm not going to spend a bunch of time there, but I wanted to touch on it so we could begin to think about, as we go forward into this, what Jesus is talking about in this next bunch of parables. Because what he's talking about in the next bunch of parables, this idea of grace, is not some kind of distant messianic Jewish issue. It's a current 21st century issue. It's one that has a lot to do with all of us and how we relate to God and to one another and to the world around us. Because it has to do with that exact kind of linkage that we were just reflecting on, the linkage between the things in life that are not right and what that has to do with God. So, in the parables about grace, Jesus sets out to undo this fundamental misunderstanding that we have to earn the right to be loved. And not surprisingly, that misunderstanding turns out to be pretty deeply lodged both in the psyche and the society of the people all around him, as it is in all of us. And so, that's a terrain we're going to be exploring for the next bit, the terrain of Jesus' parables about grace. Which, it's interesting how often, when we stand back from the biblical stories, how often it feels like Jesus is sort of setting the stage for a next thing. That there's not always a conscious deliberateness, but sometimes it feels like it comes into view. And I think this is one of those times. Because I think Jesus is sort of setting the stage for some of these ideas with stories that are well known but easily often misunderstood. And in particular, he sets the stage for this first of his parables of grace with this a well-known interaction with a small child. Lots of us know the story because lots of us know the punchline. But when the disciples are arguing about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of God, which, by the way, is a sure sign that they've completely and utterly missed the point of what sort of kingdom it is, at least so far. Last, least, lost, greatest. Anyway. So Jesus takes this little child and he stands in the middle of the group and he puts his arms around him and he says, "Whoever receives one such little child in my name receives me." It's a very punchy sort of short story in most of the Gospels. Well, we're living in the 21st century, but mostly we still have a pretty 19th century view of childhood, and that view is that childhood is a wonderful and desirable state. It's awesome. As the Lego movie says, everything is awesome. To celebrate what we perceive children to have that we don't seem to have as adults and lament the loss of those aspects of life, that's pretty normal 21st century perspective, the loss of innocence, the loss of carefreeness, the loss of joy, we could just keep on going, right? So that's the perspective we tend to have. But if we were going to sort of draw some kind of a circle or a graph or something that would visually represent known history and the portion of it during which that has been the perspective on what it means to be a child, that would be a very, very, very small portion of history during which this has been the perspective. And for the majority of human history, and certainly in Jesus' time, and in most of the centuries since, until that recent, as recently as the 19th century, childhood has been seen as really a less than fully human condition. And the sooner you can get it over with, the better. And if you need to beat it out of a child, then beat it out of them, because childhood is not a gift. And so that's the cultural framework in which Jesus brings this little child into the middle of the group and wraps his arms around him and says, unless you receive. So when he sets up a little child as an example, he isn't setting in front of us a specimen of all that is charming and simple. And this is an important idea. He's actually showing his disciples an example of a human that in a cultural context would have been considered one of life's losers. Unless you receive one such loser in my name. It's a different story, isn't it? He's not lifting up in that moment the idea of plausible greatness. He's lifting up an example of what Paul writes about later when he said that God works not in the great, wise, and powerful, but in the weak and in the foolish. That's what he's dragging into the center of the story right there. And it's basically just, it's another one of those stories that shows us how Jesus is realizing that the path that he's going to walk, and ultimately the only path that can change what's wrong in the world, is not one that leads to the top of the power heap, but one that leads to the bottom. It doesn't lead to the pinnacle of the human condition. It doesn't lead to a self-actualized, celebrated personhood, but it leads to the very depths of the human condition. It leads to our places of lastness, lostness, and leastness. It leads to the kind of places that we were thinking about when we thought about our secrets. It leads to those kind of places. And Jesus is insisting that it's out there, in the bleak places and the broken places that we can encounter and learn from the love of God in ways that change our understanding of God and of the world and of our place in it. That's where that happens. All right, well, it'd be fair to say that was more than a brief review, but that's one way to view how the Gospels show us Jesus is trying to set the stage for his followers then and now to reconsider what kind of a world saver Jesus is and how that isn't going to look like what they thought it should look like, how that isn't going to look like what they would regard as plausible. So, on to the story of the fish that I alluded to in the blurb. I'm just going to read us the story. It's short. After Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma temple tax came to Peter and asked, "Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax?" "Yes, he does," he replied. I think it's important to imagine Peter answering that without really thinking about it, the way he did a lot of things. When Peter came into the house, Jesus was the first to speak. "What do you think, Simon?" he asked. From whom do the kings of earth collect duty and taxes? From their own children or from others?" "From others," Peter answered. "Then the children are free," Jesus said to him. "But, so that we may not cause offense, go to the lake and throw out your line. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a satyr, which is a 4 drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours." End of story. So like I said, it's a fish story. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but there are lots of biblical critics who basically toss this particular fish story back in. Saying that his tone is too much like sort of the frivolous miracles that are attributed to Jesus in the apocryphal Gospels, which are basically the Gospels that didn't make the cut.
And there's lots of stories in there about Jesus making clay animals and birds and then bringing them to life and healing his playmates. And it's fascinating stuff. And I think it's important to not regard the apocryphal gospels as not gospels, for what that's worth. But a lot of critics would just say, oh, no, this is a floating fragment, and Matthew needed somewhere to moor it, so he put it onto the end of the chapter here, and that's that. And then, of course, if we were going to, if we wanted to engage in this debate, which we're not going to, you could spend lots of time and energy on questions like, did the story literally happen or not? I was at a wedding on the weekend, and I got cornered by a slightly tipsy wedding guest who was determined to convince me about the literal young earth nature of certain features of the history of the planet. And from his vantage point, he was talking to a wedding photographer, and I didn't disabuse him of that. I just let him run. And it was fascinating. Anyway, partly I didn't disabuse him because it wasn't my place to, and partly also because in the course of his insistent sharing of what he believed, it came clear that that engaging with what he believed had saved his life, quite literally. And I thought, well, wouldn't that just be a silly thing to argue about now? And that's kind of how I want to comment some of those questions today, not dismissively, but rather in a way that says, well, here's the story as we're given it. Here's how it sits on the page, and let's work with what we're given. And so we're going to start on that foot. So what's going on in this particular fish story? Well, let me just say for the biblical scholar types in this community, and there are some, that I'm aware of the translation challenges with this story, as well as with the general conversation about whether it belongs where it is or not. And I'm going to knowingly skip over all that, not because it doesn't matter, but because it's just not the focus I've chosen. So if we want to talk about how we ended up with the word child, we can do that. It's actually quite a complex translation challenge, and it's an important one. So anyway, all that review we did a few minutes ago, all that business about Jesus' perspective on what kind of Messiah he was and wasn't, well, it seems to me that by the time Jesus gets to this point in his story, by the time he gets to this point in his life, he's settled enough about his own understanding that at the heart of how he's going to be a world changer or a Messiah, at the heart of that story lies his own death. And that his own moment in going to the very edges of the human condition, to the ultimate lastness, is where the action is going to be. And that understanding and his own settledness about it has liberated him from the old political, religious, and ethical messianic expectations enough to make a joke about them. And he doesn't just make a joke, he acts it out, which is even better. And so from the beginning of the story of Jesus, he hasn't been all that comfy with kind of the plausible explanations or the plausible version of what a Messiah should be. I mean, this is a guy who broke the Sabbath from the beginning. This is a guy who insisted on hanging out with the morally unacceptable from the religious leader's point of view. But by this point in the story, I think he's pretty much, he knows in his own spirit, and I think there's increasing evidence around him in the society, that he's pretty much beyond the bounds of acting like a plausible world saver. At this point, he's kind of, that ship has sailed. That's just not going to happen. And he couldn't have the things he's done back. And so what he does in this parable is he does something playful. It's as if he is, in this moment in the story, he's free of the weight of expectations. My poor children, you know, they have to live with a father who finds it hard to shed the things that he needs to shed sometimes and just set them aside. And so I'll be awfully serious in the wrong moment, you know. God help them. Yeah, and their mother too, of course. But I know partly because of that, and my children help me with this, I know the difference in how it feels to wish to laugh when you feel the weight of expectation and to just laugh and not feel that weight. They're profoundly different experiences. A laugh that just bursts out of you is different than one that you have to wrestle into existence, isn't it? And I think there's a little bit of bah right here. And it's like we're watching Jesus act a bit of what Paul eventually writes about in Romans 8 when he talks about the glorious liberty of the children of God. Just a little bit of it kind of bleeds into this story. So here we go. This is my take on this parable. It's not unique to me. It draws on other people's thoughts about it, but I found myself feeling quite at home in it. First of all, as any comedian will tell you, if you actually want the punchline to work, the joke has to have a setup. This is not slapstick funny. It's whimsically funny. And that's important. But in this parable, this acted parable, Peter is sort of the fall guy. And I think Peter would be a perfect fall guy because he's so serious. He's so intense, right? Like, how do you improve on that for a fall guy, right? You just get somebody who doesn't get the joke because he's, you know, all the time. And this is the guy who called Jesus down, you know? I mean, the perfect guy. So
Peter as Dwight from The Office.
What's that?
Peter as Dwight from The Office.
There you go. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So Jesus sets him up by asking sort of this whimsical rabbinical question. It's kind of Socratic. It's kind of one of those questions where the learner learns by, you know, answering the question. They learn for themselves. The setup in the shape of the parable is kind of interesting because as far as we can tell from the narrative we have, the conversation Peter has about whether Jesus pays the temple tax happens outside. Jesus isn't there for that. Peter walks into the room and the first question Jesus asks him is about the temple tax. So it's kind of already like, whoop, a little bit spooky, a little bit weird. So he asks Peter this sort of whimsical rabbinical, you know, question. What do you think, Peter, or Simon, he says, what to whom do the kings of earth collect duty? From whom? From their own children or from others? Said the teacher. And the student says, well, from others. And it's pretty much a rhetorical question. It has an obvious answer as framed by the question. And Peter gets the answer right. But then Jesus follows up the correct answer with this kind of blithely sweeping declaration of independence. He says then those children are free from that system, right? About this whole system of the kings of earth. And then he concocts this slightly ridiculous mixture of consideration for others, so we don't cause offense. And then the frivolous, sort of this pull the rabbit out of the magical hat thing that happens with the fish instead of the rabbit. And then this financial precision. Inside the fish's mouth, you're going to find exactly the amount for my tax and yours. It's kind of ludicrous, the whole thing. It's just, right? It's ridiculous. And at some level, I just have this feeling that Jesus is just playing. He's in the way that we're invited to play with the truth of things. But at another level, I think he's sending a message that is messianic, that is world-saving. And that message is found, as we have it in the text, in Jesus' words, "Then the children are free." And it's a message of considerable weight. Because essentially, it's a message about the end of religion. It's as if Jesus is saying that whatever religion was trying to do, and in this case he's directly talking about the religion of the temple, because the tax in question in the story is a temple tax, but by extension he's talking about all religion. What Jesus is saying is that whatever religion was trying to do, that thing that it's trying to do will not be accomplished by religious acts in the end, at all, but by that last least lost death story of Jesus. And we humans, I think, are a profoundly and sometimes desperately religious bunch. I don't think there is a human that is immune to the temptation to think that whatever's not quite right about our relationship with God, it can be repaired from our side by our effort. And those efforts take lots of different shapes, right? For some of us, it's about right belief. It's doctrinal. It's about our commitment to knowing and being able to defend a certain creed or a certain shape of ideology. For some of us, that belief that this rift can be repaired from our side is about cultic performance. It's about singing the right songs, doing the right dances, getting into the right sort of spiritual space or behavior. For some, it's about ethical achievements. It's about the rightness of what we do. And for some of us, it's pretty much just superstition. But whatever shape it takes, at the heart of it, it's the same thing. At the heart of it, we're trying either by our doctrinal orthodoxy or by our chicken sacrifices or by our moral straining or by throwing salt over our shoulder or by hanging the bath towel up a certain way or by not shaving during the playoffs or, you know, whatever we're doing. We're trying to somehow get the God of the universe to either become kind-hearted or soft-headed. We're kind of trying to get God to... ease up. But if we aren't convinced by the ancient
argument that we find in Christianity's sacred text in Hebrews that none of that works, then maybe life should have taught us by now that push come to shove, none of us has a card in our hand that can trump God. We just don't have it in the end. I think I mentioned last week this idea that religion's only real work is to remind us of what we know in part. Richard Rohr's idea. I like that idea a lot, and it's very thoughtfully said by Rohr. I would add to it that I think religion is right in its insistence that something needs to be done about our relationship with God, but other than that, what religion tends to do usually is trap us in a game that we will always and everywhere lose. To frame the dilemma in a way that puts the onus on us to mend what's broken by our own effort and our own behavior. And where that leaves us, to use sort of a contemporary manufacturing image, is it basically leaves us in what amounts to the sweatshop of religion. It leaves us trying like mad to make the religious thing that will fix whatever it is in front of us that's broken. How many of you guys watched the World Cup, the FIFA, any of the FIFA stuff? Yeah. Just a little bit. Anybody catch those desperate moments when the camera cut away to the sidelines while the penalty kicks or the shootouts were happening at the end of a bunch of those overtime games? Yeah. This is what killed me about that. The guys on the sidelines, speed crossing themselves. Anybody see this? Like if I can pray faster than the guys on the other side of the bench, we're going to win. I'm going, man. And they just like head down, and it was just a blur. I cracked up. I thought, that's it. That's not the idea of praying about something we care about, and not the idea of a particular ritualistic behavior. That wasn't what cracked me up. I think what cracked me up was that I saw myself. Like I saw my own religious behavior in those moments. I saw the franticness of trying to cause God to do something by religious behavior. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about this idea of the sweatshop of religion, this idea that when we do that, we get into this space where it's just this straining, groaning, fruitless business of trying to make right what we cannot make right. And Jesus kind of takes that whole enterprise, that whole religious sweatshop idea, and he kind of nails this gone fishing sign over the door and just says, anyone who's laboring inside of that doesn't need to keep going. Come out here, onto the beach and sit by the lake with me and see for yourself that I am not some kind of cosmic bookkeeper who is waiting to settle a score with people who owe him what they can never pay him. And if it's laugh or cry, then there's moments to laugh about that too, where it's just like, throw your fish in the lake and take your line in the lake and take the first fish, and the religious tax, whatever you owe religion, is going to be in the fish. Bah. That's silly. That's awesome. That's the liberty of the children of God. We didn't become that by dint of our effort. We don't remain that by dint of our effort. What our effort tends to do, as Hebrews reminds us, among other places, is make it clear to us that no matter how hard we work, that's not the way. And so that's how Jesus sets in motion, in parabolic acted motion, in the Gospels, the idea of grace. The idea of God's unmerited favor coming
to us with a kind of both unbidden and even unimaginable generosity. So extraordinary that sometimes you just gotta laugh. Peace.